The foregoing interview was conducted at Mr. Freese's home in Rumson, New Jersey. Mr. Freese continues, and he says that he iterates that Jansky's technical competence lay more in his ability to measure and observe phenomenon than it does in designing electronic equipment. He says that Jansky was a very mild fellow, not too aggressive. The fact that the studies in radio astronomy required advanced equipment, the type not yet built, and where the state-of-the-art was not up to date yet, may have possibly deterred him from insisting to continue on his work in radio astronomy. Mr. Freese continues, and he says that Jansky was neither discouraged nor encouraged to continue in this field. Nobody at that time felt that radio astronomy was a field of overwhelming importance. This factor came to the surface many years later. I believe this is somewhat documented in a letter by... This apparently seems to be the view of Mr. John C. Schelling, formerly Director of Research, of Radio Research, at Homedale, and whose home I am at the present time in Interlaken, New Jersey. Mr. Schelling writes a letter dated October 16, 1956, to the editor of Science. It concerns the review of John Pfeiffer's book, The Changing Universe. The letter reads as follows. Mr. Schelling writes as follows. Your issue of September 21st, 1956, contained a review of an interesting book, quote, The Changing Universe, unquote, by John Pfeiffer. The book raises a question why Carl Jansky, after discovering extraterrestrial noise at the Bell Telephone Laboratories, stopped his work, quote, at the very point where it was beginning to get exciting, unquote. The author, it seems, is trying to be factual and to present both sides of his question. On the other hand, your reviewer, Frank K. Edmondson, an astronomer, does not hesitate by implication to pass judgment. Speaking of Jansky's, quote, failure to secure support for continued pure research at Bell Laboratories, unquote, his statement that, quote, industry has developed a more enlightened attitude toward pure research during the past 25 years, unquote, is harmless, in quotation, but in context, not as innocent as it looks. It is news to Mr. Jansky's associate at Homedale to be told that he tried seriously to continue the work and failed. If he made such an attempt, the effort was without forcefulness, and it is the consensus of his fellow workers that he showed no sense of frustration. I remember a conversation with him shortly after reading a Grote Reber's paper describing his first mapping of the Milky Way. Greatly impressed by Reber's single-handed and successful effort, I remarked that it was too bad that Carl was not himself working in the field. To this he replied cheerfully that after all, he had skimmed the cream. There was no sign of disappointment. It is therefore thoughtless, to say the least, to refer to, quote, his failure to secure support for continued pure research, unquote. If astronomers had been knocking at the laboratory's door requesting cooperation and had been refused, there might well be ground for criticism of an organization which would permit a pioneer to stop, quote, at the very point where it was beginning to get exciting, unquote. If the astronomers showed any excitement at the time, we saw no sign of it. As the years passed, it became painfully evident that they did not even believe in radio noise from the center of the galaxy. The Bell Telephone Laboratories provided the environment and support which made this discovery possible. It cooperated in communicating it to the scientific world. All interested in the advance of science became free to enter the important new field if they recognized it as such. If confirmation was needed, it could best be done by others, since the possibilities of available apparatus were exhausted by Jansky's 3 papers. Knowing what we know today, it is easy to forget the actual situation in 1933. If it was so obvious that this was to be an important branch of astronomy, that as the reviewer says, quote, the division between radio astronomy and optical astronomy is an artificial division, unquote, why did it take so many years for the world of astronomy to become aware of the fact? Newcomers can exercise what W.O. Baker has called, quote, the exquisite precision of hindsight, unquote. It is entirely possible. It must be admitted that decisions made 20 years ago might have been quite different if a crystal ball had been at hand, signed J.C. Schelling. Mr. Schelling, was this letter ever sent?
Yeah.
No, I think it's right into here.
Fine. Is it?
Yeah.
All
right.
Yes, it was sent. And there was correspondence between the editor, I've forgotten his name, and myself. At first, he was very reluctant to accept it. Then I wrote a letter, and he finally did accept it. Wait, was there a question?
Yes, the question was if it was, if you ever sent it, and if it was published, if the letter was published.
Finally, he did accept it, and
that's the editor of the.
Finally, the editor accepted the thing for publication, and it was actually, I believe, scheduled. Unfortunately, I had some afterthoughts on this. I'm sorry now that I did discontinue. I mean, I asked that the thing be withdrawn, and that was at my own request.
Well, you asked the editor of Science to withdraw this.
I did. Yes, we had
a
telephone
call. Do you recall the reason for this?
What was that?
Do you know the reason for this?
Well, I think there were various reasons. For one thing, I think the tone of the letter struck me perhaps as sarcastic a bit, and I have a feeling that sarcasm is bad. I also asked George Southworth, to whom I had sent a copy of the letter, what he thought about it. He was quite strong in the opinion that it should not be sent, that it would do more harm than good. I think that myself right now that it is unfortunate. But by the way, I talked with Priest about it, and I told him that I wanted to withdraw it, and asked him if he objected. And at the time, and I understood that he did not object to it, but apparently there was a misunderstanding between us. And I don't know just how it happened.
Wasn't he the one that originally requested you to draft this letter?
Oh, no. He did, well, the drafting was my initiative.
It was your initiative.
It was my initiative. Yes, the drafting was my initiative. He saw it and liked it. Later, when I found that Friess and I had not understood each other, I felt very bad about having withdrawn this letter, but it was then too late.
Let's get on to an interesting point, Mr. Schelling. I'd like to know what the significance of 20 megacycles, that is 14 meters, is. In Jansky's work, his job was to find out various static coming from various causes in various directions. What was so important about one particular frequency or one narrow band of frequencies? Isn't there noise generated in other frequencies?
Well, this high frequency range that he was working in was one which was very important for our transatlantic short wave, or rather high frequency communications. At lower frequencies, as I think you just indicated, static does become worse. If you go to higher frequencies, it is not as serious, at least a good deal of the time, as is the low frequencies, because of the what's known as the skip phenomenon. If you go considerably higher than that, why, the noise from distant sources does not come in the way it does at low frequencies, just because the ionosphere is insufficiently ionized to hold it down.
I see. I guess what I had on my mind was the magic number 21 centimeters. This is the fundamental frequency of a hydrogen emits.
Oh, no. Now this
and
is
that is the radio astronomy frequency.
Oh, yeah.
The celebrated one.
You know, but that's quite different, of course. That 21 centimeters is, I think, 1,400 some odd kilocycle, a very much higher frequency.
Did he experiment with that frequency?
Oh, no.
He didn't touch that?
No.
Do you know who the first one was that did that work? Was it Reber?
Reber was certainly the first one who did anything of importance in radio astronomy at that frequency. As a matter of fact, when Jansky was working, if my recollections are right, there was very little apparatus that could have been used in that field by Jansky. There were new tubes being developed all the time. I mean, as time went on, the frequencies at which vacuum tubes could operate was going up and up. At the time that Jansky experimented, I believe that there were some small tubes. Either in existence then or about to become into existence from the laboratories. There were also some small tubes put out by the radio corporation that called, as I recall, shoe button tubes or something of that sort, which, by the way, I think were the tubes which Reber actually used at a later time.
Yeah.
But don't get confused between this 20 megacycles and the 21.
Yes, it's an important point, because if this is a radio frequency, if it is a radio astronomy frequency, it would have proved that Jansky had built this thing primarily to detect radio noise. But you say this frequency is connected with a transatlantic circuit.
Yeah, that's right.
He was asked to build this antenna at this frequency, build the equipment for the measurement of static.
Existing communications.
Yes.
So you see the difference, the ratio of the 21 megacycles in going from that to 1,400 megacycles, which is the frequency corresponding to the 21 centimeter wave, is ratio 71. It's a tremendous range, you see.
Mr. Schelling, what was your connection at that time with the work of Jansky?
None whatever, and I'd like to make that clear, that in writing this letter, I was not in any sense writing it as one of the persons who might claim credit. I deserve no credit whatever, had no connection whatever, except as an interested bystander in the work that was going on there.
This morning, Mr. Fries mentioned that he thought that Jansky is deserving of a Nobel Prize for this work he did. Do you feel the same way? Or is that...
That's a very difficult question for me. I think that these discoveries...
Well, undoubtedly, you think it was an important discovery. Everybody...
It was important, and of course...
At the time when it was discovered, how did you feel about it?
Well, I felt, of course, it's tremendously interesting. I I think I felt just a little bit of skepticism about it.
You did?
I think so. Which finally over. I mean, in the first stages of it.
Was this shared by your colleagues at the time?
I wouldn't say so. Uh-huh. I don't know. I think maybe it's just my my attitude.
Did Jansky ever talk to you? Did you ever detect Jansky's excitement about this field and him wanting to work in radio astronomy more than he did in more conventional static problems? In other words, was he very enthusiastic about radio astronomy when he discovered it? And did he want to continue this work?
Well, the only thing I can, that I recall now is the conversation which I was mentioned in that letter that you read. I would say that I did not have enough conversations with him to before that time to base any opinion on.
I see. You don't know whether he wanted to continue the work or whether he didn't want to continue the work.
I have no. No, I don't know.
Were you close with him personally?
No. Well, I was located. See, that was in 54, 33, I believe. 33 or 34. I was at Deal at the time. That's 10 miles away, and he was at home, at Homedale, and he reported in one. He was in one department, and I was in another. Priest was in charge of. Of the work which came out of the research work on receivers, and I was at home at Deal working on transmitters and transmission and transmitting antennas. But there was a sort of a while closely related, and while we both reported to the same man in New York, there was just friendly a lot of very good friendly cooperation. But our work was. Was rather distinctly different.
And Jansky personally, was he an easygoing man? Was he did he get along well with his colleagues?
Oh yes, yes, he was well liked. I think
you wouldn't call him an aggressive fellow. In other words,
oh no,
someone that has an idea in his mind and wants to pursue it and badgers his boss about it.
No, I would say he was rather easygoing in a nice way. And this partly, of course, was due to the fact of his illness. I think what he did in the face of his illness was quite remarkable. I mean, his attitude was, which you might call heroic, I suppose, I think. He had an incurable illness, you know, of course he finally died of it.
Yes.
And this was with him all the time. He had it under control, but it was something for which he deserved a lot of credit.
Well, Mr. Schelling, during the time when you worked there, did you ever feel that if you approached management with a request for equipment, that you would be denied this? What I'm trying to establish here is the possibility of Jansky wanting to continue his work and yet being denied the equipment for it. And I'm trying to establish whether the atmosphere was such that other scientists and engineers in similar situations would make a request to their bosses and their efforts would be thwarted because of a very purposeful kind of development and research which was conducted. For example, have you ever approached management with a request for equipment, and has this ever been denied to you?
Oh yes, I don't think it would be good management if it weren't.
Yes.
After all, someone has to make the decisions, and I don't see how the Bell Telephone Laboratories can be a Croesus for. Providing funds for anything, whatever that the engineers might, the scientists might want to do. I think either thing could happen. The real point is, what did happen in this case, and
Do you think that it's very possible that management was so interested in solving the static problem that they would have thwarted any efforts on the part of pure research people to satisfy their curiosity, such as this case over here? Let me rephrase that question again. Do you think that the problem of static and the particular job at hand was so important that even the discovery of extraterrestrial noise played of little importance in the minds of management at that time? Or would have management indeed been delighted if someone were willing to pursue his interests in this in pure research rather than solving immediate problem? I want to find out the atmosphere, the feeling of the atmosphere, the climate of management at that time. Of course, today there's a lot of pure research going on, but I don't know what happened in Holmdel in 1930, 31, 32.
Well, I can assure you that if management had any of this gift of foresight, had been able to see the future, had been able to see what the importance of this discovery really was going to be, you wouldn't have been able to hold them down. They would have given everything that was needed to do it. But it is so easy to talk now of radio astronomy as though, which is a term, by the way, which was coined years and years later. Here we were back in the days when the astronomers didn't even believe in this stuff. How could anyone expect non-scientific management to see the scientific consequences of a discovery if the people who are most at home in the field turn up their nose at it?
Mm-hmm. Also, the fact that you were living through a depression, and there was a depression then, and it was a matter of dollar and cents that certain circuitry problems.